Michael Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about Japan's greatest victory, Britain's worst defeat, the capture of Singapore in 1942, masterminded by Colonel Matsubu Shuji. This is the 32nd episode. It's taken me about 20 minutes each episode, so that gives you a sort of a length of time. Here we're up to page 52. The Japanese have landed, have smashed through the Australians, and now it's just the march to the end, so to speak. Okay, it's called Slaughter on Bukit Timah. I assume it would be Australian slaughtered at this point in time, but let's see what goes on. Bukit Timah is a strategic point at Singapore Island, situated about 7.5 English miles from the northwest of the city, with an altitude of 177 meters. It's the highest point on the island. Its name is composed of two Malay words, Bukit Mountains. Timah means tin, and its meaning is therefore tin mountain. As its base, there were roughly 300 dwellings, and so rubber factories, race course, golf clubs, and so on, together with the large army storage warehouse established by the British. On the northeastern slope, situated a reservoir, the source of the water supply for Singapore's 1 million citizens. According to our intelligence reports, the strategic point appeared to be strongly fortified with concrete positions. Considering the situation seriously, it appeared that we would have to wait for an advance of our heavy guns before we could take this position by storm. It was, however, the utmost important that no opportunity for reorganization be given to the enemy. The idea of capturing the heights of Bukit Timah in the initial attack, the fortress had been constantly on our minds in a view of the manner in which the battle had developed. It decided to make an immediate assault. We were disgusted with the unseemly behaviour of the canoe division, so now, without even making a rough estimate of this position, we decided to capture the heights with the 5th and the 18th divisions only. Oh, I wonder why they're disgusted. Observing the progress of the in the battle of both divisions, we advanced on foot to the south. A small number of enemy planes which had failed to escape had been abandoned by the owners, and I looked lonely standing on the runway of the Tenga Aerodrome. I entered the British barracks. Fresh bread and soup were still on the dining tables, and clothing and suitcases belonging to the troops were lying around. Good heavens, I thought. They no doubt were considerably agitated when they escaped. The visitor knew our successful forcing the strait by our whole army had not been expected by the enemy and had come at a complete surprise. Astonished by the state of affairs revealed by inspections of the barracks, we came to our senses and realised that we had still to capture Bukit Timah Heights and the reservoir. We instinctively felt that to launch an immediate attack might be stupid and that it would be wiser to wait for the arrival of the heavy artillery. Suddenly a violent rainstorm swept over the battlefield, soaking us with rain, washing us clean of sweat. Happily, together with the soldiers of the 18th Division, we hurried through the rubber jungle to the front line. After a while, we noticed one another's faces. We all looked like Negroes. I say, look at your faces. They're as black as ink, called the troops. Yours too, Mr. Staff Officer. Ha ha ha, laughed the soldiers. None of us had noted the blackening of our faces. Soot from the burning oil tanks had been falling on the leaves of the rubber trees for several days, and heavy rain had washed it off on the troops as they passed beneath, turning their skins and uniforms jet black as the army service coat. Queer as we were in colour, we continued to grope our way to the 18th Division while trying to shelter from the rain and the rubber trees. The divisional commander, his chief of staff, Staff Officer Hashimoto, was listening silently to the reports of the guns. They agreed with us. Quote, congratulations, many thanks to your trouble. Looking closely at Lieutenant General Matsuki, I saw blood stains on his left shoulder of his coat surrounding a small hole where a bullet had penetrated. Ah, sir, you're wounded, I said. Be silent, he replied. The truth is that our boats were crossing Shahort Strait for a third time, and I was hit by the enemy machine guns, which still remained in action. While we suffered no damage during our first landing, during the second and third landings, the enemy kept firing even as they were retreating. Ugh, bad enemy. Staff Officer Harashimoto, who was close by, supplemented his divisional commander's story. During the first landing, he said, it appears Abamon kept the enemy troops well down at the bottom of the trenches. But to the second and third landings, manning their parapets, they resisted splendidly. That's Australians. At headquarters, they broke through the attack pillbox that we had occupied, and the staff officer, you lost both legs in a hand grenade explosion. Wasn't he unlucky? The divisional commander was wounded, and another staff officer received a bomb wound. It was a desperate fight. What lasted? The divisional commander said, and what about the army plans? We're still under shell fire. Our artillery has not yet crossed the strait. We're in a quandary, I tell you. This just sounds awful. The divisional commander's expression of was full of anxiety, and I had stood the difficulty of position quite well. But one remembered the obvious confusion of the enemy at Tenka Airfield. It gave one confidence that the sudden surprise attack would be perfectly carried out. The army commander wished to attack Brig Commander Heights almost immediately before the enemy came to life again and reorganised. As there were no guns to support the attack, it would have to be made at night with bayonet. The only comment of the 18th Division Commander, I hope the Australians are not there, if the army commander, quote, if the army commander thinks it should be done, we will make full strength surprise attack tonight with our division commander at the lead. The attack should be made by the evening, but the enemy has time to rally. It was a comment that expressed the high morale of the division. Going on the 5th Division, we asked their opinion after the Lieutenant General Metsu had told the views of the Army Commander to Lieutenant General Matsukisi. He replied, quote, if Mutaguchi can do it, so can I. My division will make the attack without artillery support. Both the divisions thus agreed to make a night attack. As the result proved, the decision was thoroughly sound. The attack was perfectly successful. Now, when I left Army headquarters, I was ordered by General Yamashita to coordinate each division's actions in accordance with the conditions on the ground. At the time, I had no data which to decide whether we should make an attack or resume attack after our heavy guns had closed across the strait. Whether because of the Kanuki Division's feint attack or other reasons, the enemy's main forces still faced the Kanuki Division as Little Hearty Changi Fortress sector. The 8th Australian Division was defending a broad front. The key Berkutama position was almost vacant. In the barracks of Tenga Aerodrome, I got the idea of surprising a vacant nest. The plan provided for the 5th Division to attack with its full strength on the north side of Chachu Kane Road, and the 18th Division with its full strength on the south side on the crest of Berkutama Heights was the objective. The advance commenced at dark, and throughout the nights of the 8th and 11th century, the battle zone was in an extreme state of tumult. Army headquarters, consisting of about 40 persons, including the army commander, moved for position in a fortified enemy anti-aircraft gun position at the edge of the jungle to the south of Tenka Airfield. Apparently, the enemy had hastily constructed a position at the outbreak of hostilities. It consisted of a single barrack building around which a trench surrounded by barbed wire entanglements. It was a key position discharging two functions simultaneously, protecting the airfields against both ground and air attack. On the evening of the 10th of February, throughout the night, the enemy gunfire raged with the most extreme intensity over the whole island. We believe that the Yuland Fortress was being defended with roughly one brigade, but the 8th Division bypassed the enemy there and pressed forward the attack on Heights, which the 5th Division had moved slightly to one side, was assaulting in the direction of the causeway. At midnight, while I was half dozing, half listening to the artillery fire, my reverie was suddenly destroyed by indications of a strong force calling around the perimeter of the headquarters. We knew the remnants of the enemy were still trailing in the sector, but we had not at once one reserve soldier at headquarters. The army commander had insisted that every available man was required by the divisions entangled in the assault. Suddenly there was a violent explosion, the barrack buildings shook, smashing windows set off a frightful din. It appeared that a number of enemy troops making an outflanking movements had fired a trench mortar into our headquarters. As I've said, the headquarters staff, including army commander, numbered no more than 40 men. A certain senior staff officer came to me, quote, can you give us some reserves quickly? Everyone company in both divisions silently, not preparing to listen, I pretended to snore, shaking my bed. He said second time, I say, do something quickly. We will all be, we'll be all right with one company. Of necessity, I got up, but I rejected to his proposals out of hand, telling him that both divisional commanders were leading their men in the night attack and were too busy to be bothered with such a request. Again, staff officer asked, "Can you get me some troops from one of the divisions? Isn't it unreasonable and rash to risk damage to headquarters? Do you want to be killed?" I replied, "We are behind the trenches and wire entanglement and have 20 sentries on guard. They're enough. I don't mind if the enemy do retreat past us." Shortly afterwards, we heard the senior adjutant giving orders to the sentry. Since the beginning of the assault, the headquarters had been enveloped in an atmosphere of tension, aggravated by the possibility of enemy trench mortars dropping bombs in the barracks buildings. I exchanged glances at Staff Officer Aceda, and we both broke into a smile. In a calm state of mind, we waited for the confusion to die down. With the approach of June the 11th, the threat headquarters passed away. To begin with, a reassuring message, quote, "I've seen Bukit Timah arrive from the 18th Division and soon a similar report from the 5th Division. Both reports were brought by dispatch officers on foot. The morning sun rose peacefully over the island battlefield of Kinsu, the anniversary of the coronation of Emperor Jimmu. The welcoming of the Kigen Festival." I don't know how that's a slaughter, but okay. "As I've mentioned, the capture of the Bukit Timah Heights was prearranged to the day, so was the period which we had determined to surrender the enemy general. Up to Kinsu, we had dreamed of surrender of Singapore, and now the dream promised to become a reality. Pinned down by the throat, the enemy perhaps would accept our advice to surrender, but we did not know. With such a hopeful observation, our note advising capitulation drafted by Staff Officer Gita was dropped from air behind the enemy lines. It read as follows. Japanese commander to the British commander. In the spirit of chivalry, you have the honour of advising your surrender. Your army, founded on the traditional spirit of Great Britain, is defending Singapore, which is completely isolated, and raising the frame of Great Britain must be the utmost exertions of heroic fighting. I disclose my respect for my innermost feelings. Nevertheless, the war situation is already determined. In the meantime, the surrender of Singapore is imminent. From now on, resistance is futile and merely increases the dangers of a million civilian inhabitants without good reason, exposing them to infliction of pain by fire and sword. Furthermore, we do not feel you will increase the frame of the British Army by further resistance. From first to last, your counsel is, Your Excellency will cease to think of meaningless resistance, and from now on, yielding to our advice promptly and immediately, will suspend the action extending over the whole British battlefront. It is expected that you will take measures to dispatch an army messenger as stated below. If, on the contrary, you continue resistance previously, it will be difficult to bear with patience from the humanitarian point of view. The inevitable must continue an intense attack in Singapore. Ending this advice, we show respect towards Your Excellency. The army messenger's route of advance shall be by the Burton Road. The army messenger hoisting a white flag as well as a British flag will stand escorted by a number of soldiers as protections. Signed, Army Commander Yamashita. The enemy aircraft guns greeted our airplanes with fierce barrage. Managing to avoid the fire, a reconnaissance plane clearly showed the Japanese marking, dropped the signalling communication tube containing the surrender advice on the outskirts of Singapore City. Strong streams of red and white fluttered from in the wind from below the tube descended. This is Japanese warfare. A signal sent from the Imperial General Headquarters and General Headquarters Army Headquarters. Quote, "The Japanese Army has stormed and captured Bukit Timah Heights and has advised the surrender of Singapore City, at which we look down. After passing the night with the sound of enemy guns, which prevented sleep the next morning, accompanied by an orderly, I examined the progress of the Battle of Bukit Sektor. We hurried along the main road in a small enemy car, which we'd been captured. We'd reached the southeastern extremity of Tenga Aerodrome. We found that the bombs of heavier caliber shells were blowing large holes in the roadway. As firing was intense, our engineers had not yet begun repairs. Abandoning the car with the orderly, I continued on foot, and just at that moment came a shell burst which shocked my eardrums while the blast jarred our spine. The flash seared my eyes and I was thrown into the roadside ditch. In my agitation, I thrust myself into the earthenware drainage pipe. Heavy shelling continued. One discharge, two discharges. At the moment, I had no experience of such heavy projectiles, which tore holes in the ground 15 or 16 metres in diameter and 4 or 5 metres deep. They were probably 15 or 16 inch fortress guns, which had been swung around 180 degrees to fire on the land instead of the water out to sea, and they were apparently attempting to demolish and bombardment of the Tango airfield and the road. Crouching like a crab inside an earthen pipe, I imagined what would happen if a shell followed me. I did not appear as if anything of myself would be left. I had landed on the island with the intention of dying, but unconsciously I drew myself further into the pipe. The shells were frightful. However, after getting to know the firing interval of the heavy guns, I raised my body, which was covered with mud and dust, and unseen by anyone, began to crawl out of the pipe. After the debris of one explosion had fallen, there was an interval of several minutes until the next shell landed. I escaped the first, the second, but still felt no guarantee of security. But at last I scrambled out of the danger zone. I rose to my feet, at the same time clearing away the spider web from my head. Quote, "It's fine, nobody was looking," I said to myself, and I felt ashamed. We arrived at Three Forked Road at the beginning. Almost immediately after the assault, our own and enemy wounded were lying where they had fallen, mingled with each other, unattended and groaning. Enemy motor cars and trucks which had been destroyed blocked in the road in all directions. It was difficult to pass through them. Reaching General Massu's headquarters at the enemy air raid shelter, I congratulated him, and together we rushed hurriedly to the crest of Bukit Timah. The soldiers of the 18th and 5th Divisions were mixed together, as reorganization had not yet commenced. From the atmosphere of the battlefield, it did not appear as if the enemy were likely to surrender immediately. I peeped up over the front of our advance line. The villages of Bukit Timah were being completely wiped out by shell fire. A soldier showed his face inside a drain pipe where he was chewing a piece of dry bread. Recalling my own position but a short time ago, I smiled wryly. As noon approached, the enemy bombard increased and the large force of enemy soldiers surged up the heights like a tidal wave, oh my god, of the cover of the barrage. They are supported by armoured cars. It appears as if the British were staking everything on a counterattack. This is gallantry, is it not? I said to myself, and involuntarily I was lost in admiration. According to our bearings, it was believed the 18th Division was separated from the 5th Division by a deep valley. A hand-to-hand struggle could be seen proceeding at the 8th Division front. I said to myself, we cannot keep on this way. Before long, we'll have to move to out of army headquarters. We must get heavy guns and tanks across the strait to support our troops. Hardly I returned to headquarters. Owing to the clumsy work of the canoe division, the causeway had not yet been reopened to traffic. The engineer regiment was now ordered to set every available man to complete repairs, notwithstanding enemy action. While awaiting the work, which we completed, all the boats were assembled and some tanks, ammunition and artillery were ferried across the strait during the day. But it was not until evening the army headquarters had moved up the mountain halfway between Tengah, Aerodrome and Bakut Heights. There was directly behind the frontline troops where the observation was good and they would be well protected. We had been prepared for heavy shelling by the enemy as soon as the presence became known. From the divisional staff officers in charge of operations, we obtained a telephone by telephone frequency and detailed reports of the progress of both divisions in the battle. The 8th, the 5th and the 8th Division, with completing each other supremacy, appeared somewhat exhausted after the day's fighting. The Canoe Division was now the only chessmen we had to play. When told, the Canoe Division can do as it pleases, they kept good countenance. And the whole division had passed the evening of the 10th of February with the enemy still on the heights of Mandai in front of them. The Canoe Division had scarcely appeared to be moving. They were now ordered to advance without a moment's loss of time on the eastern side of the reservoir to strike the enemy's flank in the midst of the counterattack of Timah. Now, this is the key solution for the difficult strategic position of the two divisions. The assistant commandant, staff officer of army headquarters, jumped to the car personally and attempted to hasten the movement of the Kanuki division without effect. The army's chief of staff repeatedly visited them, but I regret to say the petulant canoe division headquarters showed no disposition to help the other divisions in their emergencies. Those divisions maintained Those divisions that maintain the battle on their own, grasping the opportunity to further distinguish themselves despite the difficulties, while the canoe division, who had been told to do as they pleased, were having to be coaxed and cajoled like cross children. Unable to do anything about it, our affable chief of staff and strategic specialist assistant commandant appeared angry and embarrassed as we spent the evening of Kingensu, the anniversary on which we had wished to secure the surrender of Singapore, in an uncomfortable atmosphere. I accompanied with two officers on another visit to Canoke Division Headquarters. On arrival there, I said to the staff officer, Aceda, "Hello, Aceda, will you please bring me the seniority list?" "What?" he said, "the seniority list?" He was a quick-witted man, but put on this occasion appeared to be clinging back. "Oh, it's a trivial matter," I said. Matsunishimae, our three lieutenant generals, are army graduates of the same year. If by chance someone has to take command of the army, let's investigate the position. Listening by my side, our army chief of staff was assistant commandant, assumed expressions of profound thoughtfulness. During the night, the heavy enemy shells fell through the roof of the army operations sections, and two or three signal staffs were wounded by fragments of tiles. A certain staff officer, rudely awakened from the nap, agitated, ran out, clasping his pillow in his hand, calling, "Hey, this place is getting too dangerous. How about moving headquarters a little to the rear for safety's sake?" "By heavens, no," I replied. "If we have to die, let us die together in the front line. We never get another such opportunity." Throughout the fighting, there was a youth at headquarters who all the time went calmly on with his work. His name was Morita. He was 18 years old. He was an excellent, pleasant-mannered mess steward. He boiled water under the eaves and did his other jobs, looking out at intervals between shells. Without any chance of glory or promotion, he went back to his work, generally unspoiled youth. It seems to me, as human beings grow older, they hold life more precious. The avarice emerges in conformity with class advancement. Even though one's remaining days are short, there's always a lingering desire for insignificant life remains. The 5th Division attack on the reservoir in the sector at the dawn of the 12th of February had driven home by sheer weight of numbers and cooperation of the flight groups. The enemy had ceased to think of Tiernan Heights, and it was natural that they should defend desperately the heights around the circumference of the reservoir, their last lifeline. All their serviceable guns were concentrated on the area, and they seemed to be using up ammunition in their magazines. The fire position with great intensity. Also cooperating in the 5th Division was a full strength of the tank brigade and their heavy guns as they came across the strait. Realising that this was a battle to the finish, the British Army defending Singapore, we poured all our fighting strength into the battle line. It was a battle in which the fame and honour of both armies, no more, in both countries were at stake. For 5 days, the life and death struggle had continued. The 5th Division had to act in concert with the 5th in this action. The 18th Division, which had to act in contact with the 5th in this action, moved along the seacoast and drove a strong wedge into the enemy's left wing. The Canoke Division at last began to move and detour from the north of the reservoir, penetrated the flank of the enemy's main force. Thus, the general trend of the battle determined. The flight group heavily attacked an enemy convoy attempting to escape to the sea. Together with the Navy, it had in the last 15 days attacked and sunk in the waters around Singapore about 80 large and small British ships. Some of these events are recorded in Mr. Churchill's memoirs. Our army is not deployed over the whole front, and the strategic position seems to reach a climax when we received a signal from General Headquarters, quote, "On the 15th of February, an officer attached to the court of the Emperor will be dispatched to the battlefield. We can postpone the visit in the progress of your army's operations makes it desirable to do so. We wish to hear your opinion." There was someone who said, quote, "Let us welcome him," end quote, and others who argued we must postpone the visit of the Emperor's envoy for a little while, and so the opinions were divided into camps. Once previously, during the China incidents, I had been in a similar position when conducting military operations at Shanxi. Oh, God. There's lots of atrocities in that one. Together with the Itaki group, during a bitterly contested battle for the reduction of the Changshishem on 7th November, Shadi, an aide-de-camp to the the emperor arrived on the battlefield, I immediately began to think of reduction of the mountain stronghold of the Yangtze Sham. After general discussions, we were unanimously resolved. On the 15th of February, the enemy will positively surrender to the power of the august emperor. We drafted these words in a telegram to welcome the emperor's envoy. On the evening of the 14th of February, the Connecticut Division completed repairs to the causeway and pushed forward. Heavy guns moved in rapid succession to position to the heights of the east of the reservoir. First time, our whole army was across the Johor Strait and concentrated on Singapore Island. Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.